Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're with us today because we're continuing our focus on voting and voters' rights. The first batch of 2020 census information was released last week. Some states gained House seats, some lost them, but there is much more to come. The census, taken every 10 years, is one of the essential first steps to state redistricting. And as you know, this is a highly partisan process that often results in misshapen districts that benefit one party or the other. Both Democrats and Republicans work the redistricting system to get an edge. But what about the states that are trying to break that partisan hold over the process? States like Arizona, Ohio, and California. Are their methods making a difference? Two guests today and your view as a voter. What kinds of questions do you have about how gerrymandering works? Because it can be pretty complicated. Do you think the party that has state legislative control should be trusted with redrawing lines? Are there better ways to do this? So as a voter, I know you're curious about gerrymandering, how it works, why it's so complicated. Why to the victor go the spoils in a lot of states? Are there better ways to do this? Here's a phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. RJ Kennedy is with us, a commissioner at We Draw the Lines, California, with us from the Morongo Valley, California. Commissioner, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sam Wong is with us, a professor of neuroscience at Princeton University and founder of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, with us from Princeton, New Jersey. Professor Wong, I think I can see the connection between neuroscience and gerrymandering, but I'm just curious about how you got into the business.
Well, aside from the fact that it's human behavior, that's not really the way I got into it. But, neuroscience is filled with data analytics. And like many scientific fields, we have to take complicated data and make it more digestible for our colleagues. And redistricting and gerrymandering is, as you say, arcane and really deserves to be simplified so that everybody can be involved. So I got interested.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay. So, Professor Wong, I just said that in many states, the way we redistrict is to the victor go the spoils, which seems pretty undemocratic if you think about it and you think about how long we live with these lines. I guess I'm curious about when the process really became politicized.
Well, really in the last few decades, it's become worse and worse. I would say that it's always been the case that to the victor go the spoils. But in the last two cycles, starting in 2000, maybe even before then, there's been the advent of several different things, and I would think of it as means, motive, and opportunity, just like a crime procedural. So means is having computer software, which really started to get big in the 1980s, motive, which is the kind of partisanship that's gripped our nation in the last 20, 30 years, and then opportunity, single-party control over redistricting, where as we polarize and can't really find common ground, as you all too well have seen in Minnesota, it is just less and less motivating to work with the other side. And therefore, what you want is more seats for your side. And those three things have come together to create a crime scene.
Yeah. You know, we have a call here that I think really gets to the heart of everything, Commissioner Kennedy. So I'm going to take this one for you to Joe in Shoreview. Joe, I think you're hitting on a big question here. What do you want to know?
Yes. Why can't we just draw a grid over the state and base it that way so there's no odd shapes at all?
Commissioner, why the odd shapes?
Well, in part, some of these odd shapes come from existing geography that we have to take into account. Here in California, one of our line drawing criteria set in the state constitution is that we should minimize the division of counties, cities, neighborhoods, and communities of interest. Now, a lot of cities in California have odd-shaped boundaries to begin with, and if we're going to respect those, then it's possible that that's part of what's influencing the shape of the final district. We also have to take into account the actual census geography, and sometimes census geography can lead to some irregular shape. So people shouldn't be too concerned about the shape. We also have a criterion set in the state constitution that says that we should look for nearby areas of population. If we're trying to add population into a district, we should look for nearby areas of population rather than going farther away. So that's something that would mitigate against odd-shaped districts.
Yeah, Commissioner Kennedy, though, we do know that in some states, courts have had to step in to say, you've drawn that district in a way that is trying to dilute or nullify the demography of that district. I mean, we know that there are some very partisan reasons why some districts in some states get drawn the way they are. And, you know, a court will step in and say, go back to the drawing board, essentially, right?
Right. I mean, one of the other things about our process here is you heard me mention communities of interest, and the commission this year is putting a lot of time and attention into gathering communities of interest information from people across California. We're doing really extensive outreach, trying to reach every corner, every population in the state, and get them to tell us about their community of interest or communities of interest, because an individual can belong to multiple communities of interest, given that there are different kinds of communities of interest. We also have a brand new online tool developed for us by the statewide database at University of California, Berkeley, that enables people to go online and tell us about their community and draw us a map very easily. So we're hoping for a lot of input from the public so that we can use those communities of interest as the building blocks when we start putting together districts.
Yeah, Professor Wong, I want to talk about those communities of interest, because as the commissioner is saying, I guess I think of this as groups of people who have a common geographic, racial, cultural concern. How would you describe communities of interest and maybe how they get distorted if you've got a real partisan process of drawing these lines?
Right. Well, we all recognize community as the neighbors we live with, the people we shop with, we worship with, we engage in economic activity with. And so communities of interest can include racial groups, but it can include all these other things as well. Increasingly, as we draw lines to represent the diversity of the United States, it's important to recognize those. So, for instance, the caller said, why don't we just lay down a grid? I guess my counter question is, let's say there's some community like, Hmong or Blacks or Hispanics, do we lay down that grid to put a line right down through the middle of them, or do we encompass them? Do they win out or do they lose out? These communities don't live in grids the way that one might like. And so tools like representable.org, which is a tool that's available to Minnesota residents, tools like that are really valuable in documenting where we live, as well as the details of census data. And so these communities, I think, are going to be pretty important in driving a sensible conversation to make sure everyone has a seat at the table.
Yeah, Professor, I was talking about how when a redistricting process is highly partisan, and we see this in Minnesota where it often has to go to the courts, you will see this, you know, kind of distortion, because whoever the party in power is they don't want to give too much collected power of a certain community of interest, you know, when the election rolls around. I mean, we're still seeing that happen. I know courts have stepped in places like Texas and others to say you have to redraw this. It looks like you used a racial, basically a racial method to do this, but we still get a lot of those kinds of districts, don't we?
Yeah, inevitably, whoever is drawing the lines will take their own interests into account. I mean, I think that that's just natural. And so when legislators are in charge, they are obviously going to be concerned about their side's power or their own political survival. I will say that when courts are forced to step in, if they step in after the lines are drawn, the horse is kind of out of the barn, and that can take years to resolve.
Right.
However, in Minnesota, I'm going to say something contrarian. The courts stepping in as they did 10 years ago, you know, they held public hearings. They listened to people. They were not people who had to run for office. These are, if I recall correctly, either judges or retired judges. You know, as bad as it sounds to say they had to step in because the legislative process failed, it might not have been such a bad outcome because at least the people got listened to.
Okay.
Commissioner Kennedy, crazy, but that's what I think.
I know. That's kind of surprising because, I mean, we're used to thinking if it has to go to the courts, Professor, then something's gone wrong and it draws the process out and it kind of digs people into their own positions. You can see that.
Yeah, sure. But Minnesota politics is in a pretty tough place. I mean, I'm at a distance, so I can't judge. But it sure seems like there's a lot of deadlock between the Senate and the governor. And, you know, it would be ideal for them to work together. But if they can't, then, you know, when in case of fire, break glass. And
yeah, what else are you going to do?
Right.
Yeah. Conversation this morning, if you've just gotten in on it, about redistricting, part of our ongoing focus on voters and voters' rights. A lot of voters, when they kind of dip into the way redistricting works, misunderstand or are confused rightly about how these lines get drawn and who has influence over the process and why in our state and in a number of states in the upper Midwest, it ends up going to the courts. So we're trying to demystify that process a bit, and I assume you have some questions about this. What do you want to know about how and why gerrymandering works as it does? Do you think that the party that has state legislative control should basically be trusted with redrawing the lines? Is that fair in the way it comes out? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We're also talking about states that have tried to take some of the partisanship out of this process. And one of our guests, R.J. Kennedy, is a commissioner at We Draw the Lines in California. They're doing that. Sam Wong is with us. He's a professor of neuroscience at Princeton and founder of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. To the phones to John in Brooklyn Park. Hi, John. What are you curious about?
Good morning. What I'm wondering is if the technology exists today to create a district design that really drives a politician to serve the people that they are electing. A lot of districts are set up as this is the Republican district, this is the Democrat district. What would happen if a district was actually shaped like polka dots, where there are groups of people who are more conservative in one of those dots and less conservative, more liberal in the other dot, so that the politician really has to come forward to say, I'm not going to ram this particular perspective down the throats of every person who lives in this state. Instead, I've got to come with a more even-minded, more service-oriented perspective rather than I won, to the winner go the spoils.
Mm-hmm.
So does that technology exist to break things up like that?
Commissioner Kennedy, do you know?
Well, I would say that there does seem to be a consensus that the two reforms in California in particular, one, the establishment of the Citizens Redistricting Commission, and second of all, the top two primary system, where sometimes we end up with two Republicans running against each other in the general election. Sometimes we end up with two Democrats running against each other. Sometimes we end up with one and one. That those two reforms, particularly together, have resulted in, let's say, better policymaking that better reflects the desires of the people of California.
Professor Wong, we have questions about why we do districts at all. I'm trying to think, you know, given the way we send people, representatives to the House, I mean, you really, could you do this a different way?
Sure, there are different ways to do it. We have a long tradition of having these single member districts where we like to have our own legislator, our own Congress critter who speaks for us in Washington or in the state capitol, wherever they might speak for us. One of the issues is then how do you handle electing people? So long ago, 100 years ago, some states just elected the entire congressional delegation, for instance, at large, and that would give the majority an outsized vote. For instance, in southern states, it would be the white majority, and then, say, black folks would be completely left out. So you could have multi-member districts. And then, you know, let's say we had multi-member districts throughout Minnesota. You'd want to have some special voting rule, which is going to get a little fancy. You want to have a special voting rule that allows different communities or different parties or what have you in Minnesota to achieve that. And so there are some slightly complicated rules. One is called ranked choice voting that can help with multi-member districts. And I would say in answer to you and to the caller that you can build competition in some districts. Other places where there's single party dominance, or as you just asked, in a statewide level, a different kind of voting rule can make life more representative for the voters.
Wow, it's interesting. Yeah, Suzanne tweeted, why do we have to have districts? Simplify, eliminate districts, use ranked choice voting statewide to ensure everyone's vote counts. I mean, to put that through, what would each state have to vote on a decision like that to eliminate these districts?
Yes, that's a local decision. Okay. So therefore, Minnesota would have to pass a law. And so you'd have to get a productive law passed between the House and the Senate and the governor to implement ranked choice voting. Cities could do it for local elections as well. It's federalism. And so it's it can be done locally. And it would be a way to make representatives more responsive to all voters. And so it wouldn't necessarily solve all problems, but there's a certain kind of responsiveness and it drags the legislative voter, the legislator away from whoever wins the primary, right? Which isn't always favorable to all the people, but it instead drags it to what's called the median voter. And so rather than the pivot point being where the party primaries won, the pivot point becomes driven by all the people of a district.
Yeah. Commissioner Kennedy, I think for my education here and our listeners, explain, California has gotten away from this, we run the legislature so we get to draw the lines. How does your independent commission work?
Well, I think one of the keys to the commission is the selection process, which is a very long affair. It opened in early 2019. There were more than 20,000 initial applications. Those were screened. Some number of those were invited to submit supplemental application, including essay questions and a lot more information about experience and background and so forth. There were over 2,000 supplemental applications submitted.
Wow.
The state auditor's office then set up an applicant review panel, which progressively narrowed that pool of over 2,000 supplemental applications down to 120 that they wanted to interview. Now, that 120 by law is broken down into 40 Democrats, 40 Republicans, and 40 others, whether small party or no party preference. They interview those 120 and then forward a list of 60, 20 Democrats, 20 Republicans, and 20 others to the state legislature, where the legislative leaders have the ability to strike up to 24. So then the 36 who remain then go into separate random draws, one for Democrats, one for Republicans, and one for others, to come up with the first eight members of the commission. And then the first eight of us actually sat down for several weeks in August, July and August of last year to agree on a slate of six more, two Democrats, two Republicans, and two others. So that's how we get the 14. And it attempts to isolate it a bit. I mean, the legislative leadership have that ability to strike a number of the applicants, and that provision remains controversial in California. There are certainly people who would like to take the legislature out of the process completely. But I think that that long involved selection process really is part of what makes this commission, you know, as independent as it is.
Yeah. So Professor Wong, before I go back to the phones here, you've listened to this. Is the way California is getting to this independent commission, you know, squeezing as much of, I guess, the distorting partisanship out as you possibly can? And is that valuable?
It's kind of remarkable. I will say that the commissioner has given a great description. I've spoken with the previous decade's commissioners, and Republicans and Democrats alike report that even though they ended up disagreeing with each other and where some of the lines were drawn, one Republican commissioner told me that she absolutely had faith in the process and that it was a fair process, even though there were parts of the outcome she didn't like. And so, everything from having independence on the commission to requiring a supermajority to pass a plan, to the fact that they would go places together and they'd carpool, like a Republican and a Democrat would carpool together to go hear public input. I got to say, they did it, they did it.
Way to go, California. Way to go. Okay, to Michelle in Woodbury. Hi, Michelle. Glad you called in. What do you think about?
Hi, thanks so much, Gary. Yes, hi. I'm also the executive director of the League of Women Voters in the state of Minnesota.
Right, it's good to have your call.
Thanks, and it's very timely as the redistricting bills are up on the floor today here in Minnesota.
Right.
And certainly while redistricting is complicated, I wanted to add also the very simple lesson in how to ensure our maps are people powered and fair is to show up and be engaged. Minnesota has a high level of civic engagement and being, we hold the number one spot for voter turnout in the country. Mm-hmm. And during this last census, the number one state title for census self-reporting, which really made the difference in the slim count that helped us hang on to our congressional seats. So I really want to encourage people to continue to look for those ways to stay involved. We joined with the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership during the census count, and now with the leadership of the Minnesota Council on Foundations are coordinating together again through Our Maps Minnesota, ourmapsminnesota.org, to help bring all voices, especially Black, Indigenous people of color voices, to the table. So while our politics are tough in Minnesota, I want to share some optimism there, too, that people can make the difference. We will be mapping throughout the late spring and summer, and I really want to add this message of encouragement to Minnesotans to get involved in community mapping, as they've said. So,
you have a question. Yeah.
I have a question, too. All of that lead up is to say, what role have they seen civic engagement play, your guests, in helping to equalize the playing field in redistricting across the country, especially in places like North Carolina and Pennsylvania? I just really want people to see that democracy is truly accessible and that while this is a complicated issue, there's a role for individuals to play.
Think I've got it. Professor Wong, I was really glad Michelle mentioned the census, too, and participation. What's the answer to her question?
Well, there's opportunities for public input, and I will say that there are academic studies that have shown that whether it's a commission or a legislature, there is responsiveness by legislatures and commissions to public input. And so when people document their communities either by showing up at public hearings or by, say, reporting their communities through online tools like Dave's redistricting app or representable.org, these tools create a documentary record that that legislators should at a minimum pay some attention to. And I think there's a huge opportunity. Minnesota has high levels of social trust. You all are likely to take the vaccine. You all are likely to respond to the census. The degree of civic engagement in Minnesota is impressive. And I think it can make the difference between a successful process and a deadlock. At least I hope so.
I want to grab a call here from former Representative Ray Dean in Minneapolis. Representative, I'm glad you heard the show and you had a chance to call in.
Yeah, hi, Carrie. How are you?
Hi. Doing well. What are you thinking about as you listen to our discussion develop?
Well, we tried back in 2019 to set up an independent commission,
right,
and it was based on the model in California. And it was met with lots of resistance. And for some reason, the minority party at the time had huge resistance, at least a minority in the House. And in the Senate, they seemed to have no sort of desire to consider it. And it might be because of the people, it might be because of the party, because it was Republican Party control. And I guess my question to, you know, to the people today is, why does this become a partisan issue? I mean, with parties shifting from minorities and majorities, and I understand that Minnesota is unique and that we shift back and forth, but it just seems to make sense that you take the partisanship out of this. You're still going to have demographics. You're still going to have sort of party bias in some districts just because of the nature of people that live there. But there seems to be a huge amount of resistance, and I'm going to say it, from the GOP. But at the same time, there's a little bit of resistance from the party that tends to be in the majority in Minnesota, at least in statewide elections, and that's the DFL. I'll probably get in trouble for saying it, but Democratic members that that are resistant to this as
Absolutely.
Well, because it'd be better to have the control if we were in the majority, which, by the way, hasn't happened in Minnesota in the past four redistricting. All the lines have ultimately been drawn by the courts because
by
of
the courts,
lawsuits.
Right. Really good question. And by the way, Professor Wong, Representative Dean is the former chair of the House Elections Committee at our state legislature, so he knows what he's talking about. This would give, I think, and I sense that you'd agree with this, citizens and voters more confidence in the process. So the question from Representative Dean, why don't legislators agree to do this?
The obvious answer is that if they perceive that they have a chance to have some degree of control, then they want to have that input. And even if you're in the minority, let's say you're in the majority, you're in the DFL, you want to have control over the lines. If you're in the minority, then what you'd like to do is maybe carve out a seat for your side and then you'll contribute your vote. Then it has the appearance of a bipartisan plan. The GOP benefits because if we just look at shapes and we don't think about all the messy details, then looking at simple shapes favors Republicans. So it's just hard. The one case in which legislators voluntarily gave up their power was in Virginia a few years ago when the Republican majority perceived, because of demographic shifts, that they were about to lose control of both chambers of the General Assembly. And what they did was they said, okay, you know what, we're going down here. And so let's pass some amendments to bring in citizen involvement. So I think that it's just it's a natural impulse to not want to give up power. And it's unfortunate that Minnesota lacks an initiative or referendum process, because there are obvious ways to address this. And so I think that we play the cards that we've been dealt. I completely sympathize with the difficulties of passing such a law, but it would be really unusual for any legislature to voluntarily give up its power.
Yeah, I should note that Virginia, the way they work it now, is they appoint a commission of 8 legislators and 8 citizens to draw the line. And while it's probably not apartisan, it's probably less partisan. Would you agree with that?
Yes, at least there is citizen involvement, and at least it sets up conditions for success. What they do with it this fall, you know, we're all watching because it's an experiment in hybrid redistricting between legislators and citizens.
Sam Wong with us, a professor of neuroscience at Princeton, founder of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, and R.J. Kennedy with us, a commissioner at We Draw the Lines California, taking your calls and your questions this morning about why we redistrict the way we do. What is the influence of partisanship on the redistricting, and are there ways? And I think we've answered this question. Yes, there are ways to do it better, to squeeze out some of the super partisanship and give more confidence to voters. Why aren't more states doing that? Back to our conversation now as we talk about redistricting. By the way, I've mentioned our focus on voters and voters' rights. There's a show in the podcast stream where we come straight at voter fraud, because as many times as we've tried to put up facts up against the rhetoric, we still are hearing from listeners who say, but what about this and what about this? So we came at you with a lot of numbers and a lot of information. Secretary of State Steve Simon was one of the guests. If you Google NPR News with Carrie Miller and voter fraud, I think that show should pop up, and I think it's worth a listen. Okay, back to the conversation to the phones here to Tom in Minneapolis. Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for waiting. Glad to get to your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I think about this, and I try to come up with, in my mind, what would be the best and most equitable distribution of districts, I'm not sure, I can't quite get to a conclusion. If I think of a state with 10 congressional districts, and if you get them all split really 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats, in any given year, there's a little bit of advantage for the Democrats or the Republicans, perhaps. And so, you know, if they get 51% of the vote in each of those districts, then it's all 10 districts are represented by one party, but 49% of the state is then kind of unrepresented in a sense. I just can't quite get a picture in my mind of what real equitable redistricting looks like.
Commissioner Kennedy, are you arguing that California is doing that?
No, not necessarily. I mean, we do feel that the independence of the redistricting commission takes as much of the partisanship out of it as possible. But of course, as has been said earlier in the show, you know, there are other ways of doing it, including multi-member districts or straight proportional representation. You know, every electoral system has pluses and every electoral system has minuses. You know, I've helped organize elections in countries around the world for the last 30 years, and I've seen many, many, many options for doing it. You can design an electoral system pretty much to do anything that you really want it to do. There are, you know, tweaks in the various aspects of the system that you can make that will fine-tune it one way or another. So, you know, this is a feature of the single-member district system that we have, basically.
Professor Wong, here's Chris in Minneapolis who called and says, is it possible to take out the human equation and just use data to draw the lines based on locations and quantities of people rather than political voting patterns? Why did this become partisan?
Well, Chris, it is possible to do that, although I would have to say that despite being a nerdy quantitative guy who does computer simulations, I have a lot of questions about whether that's a good move. So it is. There are computer algorithms for automatic redistricting. There are ways to generate millions of plans at the touch of a button. If you set up your scripts correctly, there's a method called ensemble generation that's used in courts to judge whether a plan is fair. But what you end up with is plans that don't take into consideration all the local factors that may be at play. And so I think it's a tough situation. So to combine your question with the previous question, one could create a plan that actually led to reasonably proportional representation and was based on single districts. You'd have to have a whole bunch of districts with very different partisanship, and some of those districts might not be so pleasingly shaped. So I think automatic redistricting, unfortunately, doesn't work except in a court of law to judge whether something has gotten out of whack. Ultimately, you could use it as an assistive device to help human redistrictors look at possibilities. I think that would be a possible way to deal with, to use computers. But yeah, one has to. It's like building a table. You have to do a lot of things, and you can build an ugly table that's balanced. But you actually have to have the table be useful for human beings to use.
You know, I had one other question on the data and the uniqueness of Minnesota's divided state government. I think we are one of only four states where there's divided state government and the legislature is in charge of redistricting. Louisiana, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania are the others. Does that give the governor in those states like ours and the three others a lot more weight in the process, or is it just that it will inevitably kind of end up in the courts and the political players don't end up being that important?
The governor only gets to sign or veto legislation that comes out of the legislature. And so fundamentally, at least in principle, the legislature is in the driver's seat. If the governor has staff that can give feedback saying, well, you know, you didn't treat this community very well, or we scored this according to some general metrics in our report card, or our metrics tell us that you've managed to draw a gerrymander that disfavors one party or one ethnic group. Those are all things that the governor can do, but the governor must do it through a veto message. And so fundamentally, the governor is going to have staff who's going to score these things according to partisan metrics, racial fairness metrics. All that scoring is going to be very important. And it all gets funneled into yes or no. And that's the issue that the governor faces.
I guess I was thinking about the way governors have communicated on this before, where they will say, you know, if it's unfair, if the process is tipped, you know, I'm going to veto it. You know, the kind of messaging that they do through the process can, I guess, influence. But as I said, it usually ends up in the courts. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, just, you know, these issues are complicated. And I will say that, here at Princeton, our team at gerrymander.princeton.edu is coming up with guides, just simple ways to make this whole process a little bit less confusing, less scary. And I dare say, no offense to the legal teams and so on serving the governor, I think anybody finds this whole process a little bit arcane. And we're preparing information to help out a little bit.
That's great. To the phones here to Wayne in Proctor. Hi, Wayne.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Well, it's been kind of mentioned before, the last four redistricting has been done by judges in Minnesota, and they've been very fair because the legislature has flipped back and forth.
So you think that's kind of an indication that the judges step in and we end up with a pretty fair result?
Yeah.
Commissioner Kennedy, I assume that we draw the lines, comes up with a plan, and you avert the kind of court intervention that we seem to require, as do so many other states.
Well, the California Citizens Redistricting Commission is responsible for approving maps and submitting them to the Secretary of State. Now, our maps are still subject to referendum. If someone gathers enough signatures, they can put our maps on the ballot. They can still challenge our maps in court. But we are the body that is responsible for coming up with and approving the maps for California by a special majority of our 14 members. We have to have at least 3 Democrats, at least 3 Republicans, and at least 3 others approving a plan in order for it to be submitted to the Secretary of State. And then, you know, if for some reason we don't manage to reach that special majority, then the job does pass to the courts.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. Here's the other thing I'm curious about. When you're in the heat of this, of working on the lines, you're all around a table. I mean, can you see the political agendas or beliefs of the individual commissioners at work on the process? Or do you see that people, there's something about this process that people tend to maybe push that into the background? You know, I don't want to be too idealistic about this, but the way you described the creation of this commission is pretty, pretty hopeful. So now I'm interested in what happens when you all get in a room.
Well, we haven't been in that room yet to draw maps. We've been in the room number of other things. And, you know, from my experience on projects, you know, other places, other times, I would say that, you know, there is a tendency, you know, once you work together for a certain length of time, for, you know, your affinities to maybe, you know, focus more on getting the job done that you're there to do. And so, you know, we have made some difficult decisions, far more easily than I would have expected.
Really?
And that's not necessarily saying that we're going to manage that throughout. But for a group of people that is very diverse, we manage to get things done. We talk a lot, but, in the end, that's good. And the public sees all of that happening.
Yeah. Let me note for listeners here that Arizona, Alaska, Montana, Michigan, Washington, Colorado, Idaho, California, and New York use these independent commissions to draw their state and federal districts. Professor Wong, can you look to, do those states basically do it the same way? And do you look to the results of those processes and say, this is about as fair as you can make it in the kind of political environment that we're in these days?
Well, the processes are not all exactly the same. In some places, the plans are legally binding, and so there's no role for the legislature. That includes California, Arizona, Colorado, I believe. Other places, it's advisory, and so then the legislature is on the hot seat and either has to accept the plan or, if they reject it, come up with their own. And so the rules tend to vary a little bit. Broadly speaking, independent commissions do lead to fair outcomes. I believe, if I recall correctly, Chris Warshaw, a political scientist, and his collaborators have looked into this, and they found that in the last decade, which is really when these commissions have really blossomed, those commissions tend to lead to less partisan outcomes, tend to respect community interests more. I think someone else did that work. So overall, I think the empirical evidence is that they do a pretty good job of defanging the partisanship and maybe leading to less volatile outcomes where it depends on who happens to be in charge in years ending in a one.
Right. Ava tweets, why is the process of drawing districts allowed to be a partisan process at all? It seems like it would be a lot more effective and equitable to have a third party in charge of analyzing the data and drawing district lines. Is it political because ultimately then whatever the result is goes back to the state legislature to be approved?
The founders. They thought of a lot of things and they were pretty clever, but it didn't occur to them that things would devolve into factions. Because if you go back to people like James Madison, they thought that it would take too long to travel from one part of the country to another or what have you, and it would just be really hard to factionalize. And they didn't see the advent of parties coming, and they certainly didn't see the last 20 years of partisanship coming. And so it's just it's a legacy system we're stuck with. And until there's a constitutional amendment or a federal law, something like H.R. 1 in Washington, D.C., the federal government has the power to regulate these things. But until we get something like that, we are stuck with this somewhat rickety system that involves legislatures in about half the states.
Commissioner Kennedy, I'm curious about, I wanted to talk a little bit about innovation in redistricting. I'm curious with the kind of knowledge you have of the way California works, if you can think of a way that would be even fairer, even more confidence inspiring of voters. Are there ways to do something even better than the way you're doing it now there?
You know, I'm on the commission's lessons learned subcommittee, and this is probably something that we'll be discussing next year. We actually have the authority to propose changes, but we can't propose any changes in a year ending in 9-0 or 1. So we're focusing on getting our work done this year, trying to collect lessons learned along the way. And then next year, we will be having a robust discussion of those lessons learned and what proposals we might put forward for legislative change.
I love the fact that you're part of a committee called Lessons Learned. That is so smart.
Well, you know, in part that comes from my work with the United Nations, where lessons learned exercises are a very important part of what we do. And I've led several of these in countries where I've worked for the UN.
And so you brought your experience in diplomacy, which really makes a lot of sense to me. You've brought your experience in diplomacy into something that can be pretty complicated and, as we've said, arcane. Have you ended up using those skills that you developed as an international diplomat?
Well, I mean, I was an international electoral expert. I picked up some diplomatic skills along the way, rubbing elbows with some very good diplomats that I've worked with. But my work tended to be on the technical side, helping countries organize and administer their elections. But sure, I mean, it has all been useful in getting me to this point.
Commissioner, a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for, I think we've benefited from your experience. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
RJ Kennedy is a commissioner at We Draw the Lines, California. Professor Wong, I wanted to hear from you on innovation, something that would really, I'm sure you're thinking about this, something that would really inspire confidence from voters, even if states are reluctant to do it. What's on the vanguard of innovation here?
Yes, we've got a larger effort at Princeton. It's called the Electoral Innovation Lab, and we are very interested in understanding ways informed by research evidence to make democracy more representative, more responsive. This year, it's redistricting, and so we're developing a report card so people can respond as rapidly as possible, because technology has really enabled not only the bad deeds, but enabled given citizens potentially the power to talk back. Other voting reforms around the country are really exciting to watch. Ranked choice voting, there are versions of it in Alaska and Maine. And again, these are laboratories of democracy in the states. And so it's just, despite national troubles in politics, it's a really exciting time for democracy because we can see these things growing and bubbling up. And I have to say, despite all the difficulties in our national conversation, I'm pretty optimistic.
You know, and I think that's what Michelle was telling us from the League of Women Voters when she called in, that citizens don't have to feel like bystanders in the process, right? Well, I voted, and now my service as a citizen is done. I think I hear you saying there's a way to bring more citizen input into these processes and force, you know, change and equity into them. Is that right?
That's right. And we see it around the country. I mean, some of the times the difficulties are there aren't easy legal means to achieve it because of the structure of the state constitution. But at the city level, at the state level, at the national level, citizen engagement is more critical than ever. If we want to keep our democracy next 5 to 10 years, absolutely, all hands on deck.
Well, Professor, I'll be on your website at Princeton, and I loved having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sam Wong is a professor of neuroscience at Princeton University and founder of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project and Princeton Election Consortium.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.